Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Audrey Waters. Audrey is a writer on education and technology. She's the creator of the popular blog Hack Education and the author of widely read annual reviews of education technology news and products. She's also the author of the newly published book, Teaching Machines, The History of Personalized Learning. Audrey, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So let me start by asking you about the title of your book, Teaching Machines. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the term, what is a teaching machine?
Well, I'll say my book is a book of history. And so really, teaching machines are most often associated with mechanical, pre-digital devices from the 1950s and 60s. In fact, I think most people would think of B.F. Skinner as sort of the inventor of the teaching machine. He wasn't. And they predate Skinner's work. But I also argue in the book that there really is this long-lasting, this legacy of the teaching machine, of these mechanical devices well into the kinds of software that we see today that we call personalized learning.
So the casual observer might ask, just like what you were just saying, aren't teaching machines new? Isn't personalized learning something that happened in the last 10 years? Didn't this all start with Chromebook and YouTube and Khan Academy? But is that where teaching machines started? And if not, where in this story did you start to make your examination?
Well, I'll start with actually me personally. One of the things that fascinates me about ed tech, and particularly I would say the entrepreneurial ed tech, is a lot of the people who are some of the most high-profile promoters seem to believe that they're the ones who came up with this idea, and that somehow edtech has only existed as long as they've been in the field, right? So Saul Kahn, for example, I think would credit himself with sort of thinking that he invented personalized learning. And I think that you'll find a lot of young people who are entrepreneurs will say that you know, when they were kids or when they were in college, that was when edtech came about. And so it's sort of like our own personal use of technology seems to dictate when we talk about the beginning of edtech. But really, in my book, I wanted to demonstrate that the ideas around personalized learning were not just not new, but they were a century old, and that they predated technology. A lot of these ideas about personalization predated the technology that we use today. But you can see the ways in which a lot of the ideas around testing, around multiple choice, around data, these have been going on for so long that they have quite literally been hard-coded into the technologies that we use today. But that, you know, to the contrary of this being this brand new idea that just came about with the advent of the latest gadgetry, really this is something that has been around since the very latest, like the 1920s.
So you mentioned one of the big names today, but in your book, you focus on B.F. Skinner and Sidney Pressey. So why was it important for you to focus on these two individuals?
I would also add that I look at Ben Wood, and so those are sort of some of the three characters. Sidney Pressey was a education psychology professor at The Ohio State University. B.F. Skinner, of course, best known as a professor at Harvard. He also worked at Indiana University. And then Ben Wood, who was at Columbia University, but later was one of the co-founders of the Educational Testing Service, ETS, which I think today people are familiar with as the operator of the GRE or the TOEFL for English language learners. But one of the things that made these fellows good characters for the book wasn't simply what they contributed, and I would say that they were hugely important, but that they had a robust archive at their respective universities. And it was a really interesting opportunity for me to go through letters and papers and look at the kinds of conversations that people were having, education psychologists in particular, were having in the early to mid 20th century about the possibility of individualizing education through what then would have been their equivalent of big data and early machinery for computational machinery and educational machinery in general. And so I was able to sort of, I think, reconstruct stories about them through their archives. And I'm very, very thankful for those archives. And I do often think, you know, what historians are going to be able to do in the future, since I'm skeptical that a lot of today's ed tech entrepreneurs are going to be able to have their archives at universities. It'll be a loss.
So when you think about the learning theories that undergirded the work of these individuals, and specifically their work with teaching machines, how did Skinner and Pressey and Wood think teaching machines were supposed to help students?
Well, they were, as educational psychologists of their time almost exclusively were, they were behaviorists. They believed, Skinner in particular, I would say sort of rabidly so, was very adamant about his particular version of behaviorism being the one, the only correct version. Radical behaviorism was what Skinner was known for. But they thought that you couldn't, or Skinner in particular thought that you couldn't know what was in a student's mind, right? All that you could know were the behaviors that they exhibited, learning behaviors. And of course, educational psychology grew out of animal behavior. And so a lot of the observations that early psychologists made while observing rats, or in Skinner's case, famously pigeons, were then applied to students, to children. And so the way you would know a child was learning was the behaviors that they exhibited. And I don't mean physical behaviors. I don't mean sort of sitting still in class. I mean, anything that one would produce intellectually or academically would be a behavior that these scholars could monitor. And so a behavior would actually be completing a multiple choice test, or those would be the kinds of things. And so machinery could be built in order to document, assess, I think, and then automate both the grading the grading of these kinds of assessments for students.
So you mentioned that Skinner had a very particular kind of behaviorism. So let me ask you about the business of teaching machines. How did the business or profit-seeking industry side of EdTech interact with the likes of Pressey and Skinner and Wood?
This is one of the things that is really, I think, an important lesson for us to think about, because I think there's a really powerful narrative that the people who stand in opposition to EdTech, to quote-unquote progress, are teachers, and that somehow it's teachers that don't want technology, and it's teachers that have stopped the business of, or have slowed the business of ed tech. But really, if you look at the story of these inventors of the 20th century, you can see that it's a lot more complicated than that. And in fact, business itself was often the businesses themselves were a huge barrier to these inventors being able to bring their machines to market. Sidney Pressey, bless his heart, was sort of had some bad timing. He developed his teaching machine in the 1920s, tried to bring it to market right at the same time as the Great Depression. And for a variety of reasons, obviously, it just wasn't the right time for jobs to be automated away, if you will. But even B.F. Skinner, who was arguably the best known psychologist of the 20th century, I mean, I suppose maybe Freud can compete with that, but the best known American psychologist of the 20th century, someone with a big name and a major university behind him, could not convince corporations to build the machine as he wanted, as he designed it. The interests of profit, and I think the interests of making machines that fit a certain market, didn't coincide with what these men thought was the best science. And I think that that's the other important lesson is, you know, I think we like to think that the best the best technology and the best science is what informs the products that get to market. I think that's what education technology would want us to believe, is the things that come to market are truly the leading edge of science and technology. But I think my book shows that actually business doesn't give a damn about the science or the technology. What business wants is to be able to turn a profit. And a lot of the things that both Sidney Pressey and B.F. Skinner wanted to see simply the businesses were not interested in doing for a variety of reasons, right? Skinner, for example, tried to work with IBM. IBM was really interested in making a different kind of product. IBM was interested in automating test taking test grading. They weren't really interested in building teaching machines. Skinner tried to work with publishing companies, textbook publishers, but they weren't really interested in making a machine. They were more interested in, I think, what later we would see of as textbook and workbook materials, which in many ways, I think, do follow the kinds of things that Skinner were talking about, just without the machinery. But really, all of these, you know, Skinner and Pressey in particular, were not able to be successful, which isn't to say that teaching machines did become a big business in the early 1960s, but not the device that Skinner invented, not Skinner's device, bless his heart.
So who was targeted for the use of these products? For example, was it the wealthy kids? Was it the economically disadvantaged? Was it Black and brown kids?
Yeah, it's sort of a mixed bag. I think the most successful products in terms of the success of the business were those that were actually, I think, sold to individuals outside of schools. These were the kinds of things that would be advertised in the back of like popular mechanics, popular science magazines, encouraging people to learn new skills at home on their own time, right? We can think about sort of the job retraining in that time period, particularly encouraging more Americans to learn technological skills. But they were also sold by encyclopedia salespeople. So, you know, the door-to-door encyclopedia salesman would sort of, if you bought an encyclopedia set, you could get a teaching machine for free. And I think, again, we can think about what it was about the encyclopedia sales that appealed to, I think, a really profoundly American idea that of school as, you know, school as a mode of a way of economic opportunity. And so people were really interested in buying encyclopedias for their children because they really did believe that education was a key to success. And teaching machines kind of became bundled with that. But there were other examples as well. Skinner had this moment where he tried to convince James Conant, who had published a very well-known report on the high school, the status of high schools in the country. Skinner tried to convince him that it would be a really good idea to convince people that teaching machines were so powerful, were so efficient, were so effective, if they could be used to educate poor Black kids in Harlem. And so you can see, I think, you know, in that exchange between the two of them, something that I think we still see today, which is really poor kids of color are seen as this as the place in which edtech experimentation can happen, should happen, to demonstrate the effectiveness, but also this really kind of, you can think of it as a white savior mentality or a techno-scientific savior mentality that believes that the place in which we experiment on, the schools that we'll experiment on, quite literally experiment on, are schools that are populated by Black and brown kids. And we see that today.
So in most cases, you have parents and school leaders who tend to have questions about the things that are going to be introduced into their kids' classrooms. So were there any questions about teaching machines? Was there any skepticism? And what did the early teaching machine evangelists try to do to show that their products work?
You know, that I think that this is so interesting to me. I mean, I think that one of the things that as I was writing the book is I really didn't want to be so didactic and sort of have at the end of every paragraph, like, this is exactly what it's like today. I think I've said that like two or three times already in this discussion with you. But the echoes of these things that we could see in the 50s and 60s of what we hear today from entrepreneurs, from teachers, from parents were really profound. And I think it's, you know, if we think back to the introduction of iPads, for example, there was a lot of enthusiasm. I think parents, students, teachers, the public, there's this sort of groundswell of marketing that really sells these devices as being the silver bullet, right? And that these devices are going to educate our children quicker, better, faster, more efficiently, cheaper. And I think the thing that's often the selling point is kids are going to be really engaged. Kids are really going to love doing their worksheets on this new technology. Kids, of course, I think if you poke at that, kids would sort of say, it's still a worksheet. I mean, there's bells and whistles, but you know, at the end of the day, whether it's on paper or an iPad, a worksheet is a worksheet. And after a while, the new gadgetry gets a little dull. And I think we see the same thing with teaching machines. I think some parents were really interested in the idea of their children using the quote unquote latest and greatest devices. They wanted their children to be part of a new, you know, the new scientific and technical era. And it seemed logical in post-war America that education would become more gadgetized. Everything else was, right? And so I think that there was it really did appeal to Americans' love of science and gadgetry. But then on the other hand, I think after a while, students and parents too found these things to be really dull. I actually, when I was researching the book, I wanted to get a hold of and try for myself to use a teaching machine. I wanted just to have the experience of what it's like to learn something on a teaching machine. And I went to the place where one goes to buy old educational devices, which is eBay. And I got a hold of a device made by Teaching Machines Inc., which was a company founded by a couple of Skinner's former students. And I got a teaching machine that's a plastic teaching machine. And then the packet of, I think it was Introduction to Electricity. And I have to say, it was so boring, right? The whole idea of programmed instruction, which is sort of the mode of the format of instruction that these use, is that they break things down to the smallest possible, today we would say, I think, learning object. And that was so that in Skinner's theory, we didn't want students to have any errors. You wanted only positive behavioral reinforcement. So you wanted to reduce the number of errors. So every sort of bit of knowledge was a tiny incremental bit of knowledge that you were given. So that the student got every answer right, ideally, so that they could progress happily on to the next one. And whew, I gotta say, like, that is so boring. To move that slowly. I mean, I think I made it through 4 or 5 pages of this, and it was, you know, 800 pages of an intro to electricity. And I thought, there's just no way. And there's no amount of, you know, scrolling through this device. It's a little bit, this teaching machine that I have is a little bit like a typewriter in that you scroll the paper through to get to the next one. And that was sort of this promise that there was this new device and you'd be constantly able to turn over the next question and work on the next answer. And it's just boring. And I think that that's similar to what students experience today. Again, it's really exciting for the first couple of weeks of having an iPad. But then after a while, I think students recognize that it's drudgery, no matter what the kind of device they're using. Students know that.
So I 100% agree with you. But there's always that person who makes the argument that you could teach a kid with an algorithm, or you could just put a kid in front of a Chromebook and some learning software, and that they'll be okay. And obviously they're making that argument because they say, why would we want to pay teachers so much? So How did these early teaching machine advocates and creators think about the role of teachers with their teaching machines?
Again, it's pretty similar to today. I mean, I think a lot of the arguments that you hear aren't simply that everyone's an autodidact and we can just set everyone down in front of a computer and let them go at it. I think we can sort of see the downsides of people, quote unquote, doing their own research when it comes to things like QAnon and vaccines. But I think that what the argument is that if we allow students to move, quote unquote, move through material at their own pace, then supposedly teachers will be freed up to go around and work with each student individually and be able to sort of have more individual instruction, more individual attention with each student. And that's what I think that was the argument that Pressey made. That was the argument that Skinner made. That was the argument, in the 1920s, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, and today, is that that these machines, because they do the instruction, because they do the grading, they would free up teachers to do what teachers are best at, which is this kind of individualized attention for each student. And I think that's the story that I think gets told. But of course, you can sort of read between the lines in a lot of these stories too, that they also, many of these evangelists then and now talked about, because of that, classes would be able to be so much larger. So a teacher, because the instruction would be primarily be done by a machine, a class wouldn't be 20 students or 30 students, but a class would be hundreds of students or thousands of students, and that the student would still have individual time with a human, but most of the instruction, most of it would be done by machine. And I do think that that's still the fantasy that we hear about today, that teachers, you know, on one hand, they try to make it sound as though teachers don't have to do the grading anymore. Teachers won't have to do sort of instruction. They'll really just be like tutors, but really the classes are going to be, you know, thousands of students large.
I think if you ask any teacher, if they wanted a machine that would do their grading and do all of that stuff, and it actually worked, every single one of them would run to the store to buy it.
Well, you know, there was a, even in the 1920s, when Sidney Pressey invented his teaching machine, the students at Ohio State were like, you know, this idea of a machine being able to automate grading, they were like, wait a minute, why don't we just build a machine that automates the test taking? Because that's boring. We don't like that work either. Like, teachers might not like the grading. The students don't like doing the boring work that the teachers have to grade. And so it seems to me that the question isn't like, do we automate grading? It's like, do we stop making students do this sort of drudgery, right? Because it's drudgery for teachers to grade, but it's drudgery for teacher or for students to do as well. And so I think that that's, you know, I think students recognize that maybe if we did different assignments, maybe if we had a different way of doing assessments, we wouldn't have to automate it, because it wouldn't be boring for any of us.
So I guess the million-dollar question is, did any of this work? And if it didn't work, how did we still end up in a world where people think, some very powerful people think that technology is still the savior?
Yeah, I mean, does it work? It's so interesting to me, because I think that this is the legacy that I wanted to help uncover. So many people talk about B.F. Skinner, and I think in part it's how education psychology classes work, is or history of psychology classes work, as you read about these psychologists, these theories of psychology, and then you sort of move on to the next chapter as though that theory got supplanted, right? And so somehow we don't like Freud, that's chapter one, we don't do Freud anymore. Behaviorism, that was chapter two, we don't do behaviorism, we do cognitive science now. And I think in ed tech as well, sort of there's this idea that we left that stuff behind. So Skinner came before computers, and once computers came along, we now have a different models of learning, different ways that we theorize our machines to work. And so behaviorism isn't relevant anymore. But I think in fact that it's actually foundational to ed tech, right? It's not something that got left behind. It's not as though when people started building these sorts of teaching machines on computers, they were actually using the very same theories and a lot of the same practices of the sort of mechanical devices. And that is that early ed tech carried on to today. I mean, a lot of the software that we use, it absolutely uses the same kind of programmed instruction, really relies quite heavily on positive behavioral reinforcement. We call these things nudges, for example. Now we have different terminology. We act as though Skinner is no longer relevant, but it absolutely, I think, is foundational to the way in which technologies are still built. And you can think of that. We can look even farther back to sort of the development of standardized testing, which was really originated around the same time that Sidney Pressey was working. In fact, Sidney Pressey made a lot of money selling standardized tests. And you can see that ed tech and standardized testing are deeply, deeply connected together. And so we've built layers and layers, decades and decades of practices, assessment practices and technologies on top of this. I mean, so does it work? We can take a look at, what we have today, and I think we can be like, no. But we can take a look at what we have today and be like, yeah, I guess it does seem to work, because that is what we've done for the past century. We've done multiple choice testing. We've done standardized. We've done these kind of standardized assessments. That's where we believe we get data about students, actionable data that we make decisions about and that, guide us in certain interventions with students, guide students down certain career and course paths. So I think it's powerful stuff. I think that behaviorism is incredibly powerful stuff. And so, I mean, it works, but then I think we have to ask sort of at what cost, what have we lost by investing so heavily in a theory, particularly a theory espoused by Skinner that was really so antithetical to beliefs in human freedom and in students' agency. So we have built all of these practices in the name of individualization too. We say that this is how we individualize education by the sort of massive data collection and algorithmic judgments about students. Again, a century old, but really the trade-off is that we have really invested in standardizing a lot of things, and I think limiting the amount of choice, amount of freedom, quite literally, that students have, because they're working with these models that fundamentally don't believe in freedom, that believe that what's best is to have students engineered, and that we can engineer learning to happen more efficiently. And so that people, so that students become the kinds of people that the engineers want. Today's engineers aren't Skinner. Today's engineers are Zuckerberg and Gates. But it's, I think, a very, very similar vision. And it comes from a very similar foundational belief.
Thank you again, Audrey, for being on this month's podcast. Again, Audrey is the author of Teaching Machines, The History of Personalized Learning. As always, thanks for listening. We hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis of education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweet.